In the first hour of the program today, we will be talking about pirates. Now, as soon as I say that, I'm sure that you will have no trouble coming up with some images of pirates, no doubt drawn from a movie that you have seen, or perhaps television. And depending upon your generation and what was the last pirate movie you saw, you might find yourself thinking about Johnny Depp or maybe Errol Flynn. But one way or another, our guest for this hour of Focus 580, Colin Woodard, says all of the pirate imagery that we have, everything that we think about when you hear that word, comes from a single circle of pirates, relatively small group, a number of men and some women who all knew one another, who shared a common base in the Bahamas, and who operated for a very brief period, a 10-year period between 1715 and 1725, a time that some people have called the golden age of piracy. And we will talk this morning about some of these individuals as we talk with Colin Woodard about his new book, The Republic of Pirates. The subtitle is Being the True and Surprising Story of the Caribbean Pirates and the Man Who Brought Them Down. The book is relatively recently out now, published by Harcourt, and concentrates on the lives and experiences basically of four people, three pirates. They are Samuel Black Sam Bellamy, Edward Blackbeard Thatch, and Charles Vane. And then also the individual who was sent by the British Crown to confront them, and a man who, as our guest says, more than anyone else, put an end to the golden age of piracy. His name was Woods Rogers. As we tell the story this morning on the program, certainly questions are welcome. If you'd like to call in and talk with our guest, you can do that. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the local number. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest, Colin Woodard, is an award-winning journalist. He is the author of a number of other books, including The Lobster Coast, Rebels, Rusticators, and the Struggle for a Forgotten Frontier, and also Ocean's End, Travels Through Endangered Seas. He is, in addition, foreign correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor and the Chronicle of Higher Education. He makes his home in Portland, Maine, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. Mr. Woodard, hello.
Hi, pleasure to be here.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Absolutely.
As you mention in the book, piracy has been around for a long time. Certainly there were pirates in the ancient world, and there are pirates now. There are certain places around the world where piracy is a very serious problem and is a threat to commercial shipping. Is there something in particular, though, about this time, this relatively short time, and this place that sets it apart from the history of piracy and the history of the world?
Yeah, and first thing is that it's different from the pirates who came before and the pirates who came after in terms of their degree of success. I mean, they not only were just attacking vessels here and there, they actually succeeded in cutting off much of the commerce of three empires to the Americas. And eventually, by their zenith in 1717 to 1718, these pirates had traded up ships. You know, if they captured a ship that was somehow better as a pirate vessel than the one they had, they would take that vessel and put their captives on the other vessel and send it away and slowly trade up. And they traded up to the point where they were operating vessels every bit as powerful as any of the Royal Navy had in North America and the Caribbean to guard the empire, and had twice as many men as most of the Royal Navy frigates. So the Royal Navy was actually afraid to encounter them at all. And they were even getting to the stage where they were threatening the colonies themselves, making credible threats to invade Bermuda and set it up as a new pirate republic and to burn Philadelphia and regularly blockading Charleston and burning down French colonies in the Caribbean. So they were enormously successful. But I think the thing that really sets them apart is their motivations. And briefly, they didn't see themselves as thieves. They saw themselves as being involved in a social revolt against the ship owners and ship captains who'd made so many of their lives miserable, because most of them had been sailors in the Navy or the Merchant Marine prior to becoming pirates, and conditions were so horrific in both naval ships and merchant vessels in the day.
Yeah, that's an important point to make. I know that there are a lot of people who enjoy reading sea stories. Maybe people think of Patrick O'Brien or something like that, and I certainly have enjoyed reading them as well. But the life of a common seaman, whether in the, I think probably it would be as true in the American Navy as it would be in the British Navy, was extremely hard, and there was severe discipline verging on sadism, maybe not even verging, maybe even clearly crossing that line. So the opportunity to have a different kind of life in a different kind of atmosphere where you could actually have make some more money and where you weren't in, someone wasn't threatening to beat you every time you turn around, that had real, I'm sure, for a lot of sailors, people who had experienced life in the Royal Navy or the American Navy, had real appeal.
Absolutely. I mean, in addition to just the violence and sometimes arbitrary violence on these vessels, I mean, they were cheated out of their salaries. They were sometimes starved because unscrupulous ship owners wouldn't stock enough food. And if they were waylaid by winds and didn't make their crossing quickly enough, food would run out. You know, they were cheated in many, many ways. So there was an enormous discontent on many of these vessels. You know, Samuel Johnson, an essayist from that time period, described being a sailor then as very similar to being a prisoner, only with the added possibility of drowning.
I love that quote.
And that was definitely true, and conditions were getting worse. Salaries were getting lower, and this was sort of an actual revolt by the sailors because they felt their rights as Englishmen were being violated. And they actually called themselves, several of the crews, Robin Hood's men. And the most, you know, the first thing they did when they took over a vessel and made it into a pirate vessel is completely turn the government of the ship upside down. Instead of this brutal top-down hierarchy enforced by discipline, you know, when violence, they elected their captains. They could depose their captains at any time through a popular vote of the crew. And they had a special officer in the form of the quartermaster, whose job responsibilities included keeping track of what the captain was doing and reporting back to the crew. You know, the pirate captains generally weren't allowed to have their own captain's cabin, or if they did, they had to share them with lots and lots of crewmen. And they divided their plunder remarkably equally. You know, instead of on a, you know, privateering vessels, the sailors worked for shares of the plunder, but the owners would get half of the plunder, and then of the remainder, the captain might get 14 shares, you know, and you and I would get one. Well, on pirate vessels, of course, they'd stolen the vessel, so the owners didn't get anything. But the captain would only get maybe a share and a half to an ordinary crewman's share. So, I mean, it was definitely a radical leveling and reorganization of the way the ships worked. And the interesting thing is that not only did other sailors see them as Robin Hood's men, you know, they recruited many of their new pirates from the vessels that they captured. You know, the ordinary sailors on those vessels, you know, the would-be victims often looked at the condition the pirates had and the conditions they had on the merchant vessel and would volunteer and join them.
Yeah, that's,
interestingly, you know, a lot of people ashore also saw the pirates that way, and they appeared to be enormously popular with ordinary people in the Americas.
I think that's an interesting point as well, that I think if you ask the question, well, why is it that we find pirates interesting today, is that they we perhaps might minimize the brutality and the violence that they do and do see them in this kind of Robin Hood way. Well, as you point out, not only did the people of some of the people, at least of their day, see them that way, but some of them saw themselves that way. They even, not only did they see themselves that way, they actually used that kind of language to describe what it was they were doing. So they felt very clearly that they were doing a bit of the robbing from the, they may have kept it themselves, but certainly they were robbing from the rich, not from the poor.
Yeah, they seem to have appointed themselves as the representatives of the poor, but yes. You know, and they, you know, a lot of the pirate vessels started by sailors mutinying against conditions they found intolerable aboard ships, and they really, you know, they didn't really have the ability to seek, you know, legal, normal legal ramification for their grievances, because the ship owners tended to be enormously powerful, or, you know, were judges themselves, or the president of the Bank of England, or what have you. So it's very hard for ordinary people to challenge them. So a lot of them had sort of little choice but to, you know, break off and go live, you know, a merry life and a short one, so to speak, and, you know, become outlaws of all nations.
I think it's interesting. You point out in the economic differences between the way that things were set up if you were a privateer. And I think that the same thing would have been true if, for example, you were in the Royal Navy, that if you captured a foreign ship and you sent it home, and upon review, I think the Admiralty would have to make the decision. But if it was decided that that was a fair prize, then the proceeds were divided up among the crew. And as you say, the captain got the most, and then as you went down through the crew, everybody got sort of less and less, so that your seaman got maybe one share and the captain got many more. So captains certainly could become very wealthy. That was one of the differences between being in the Navy and being in the infantry. You captured a foreign ship, you got to profit from that. And the big difference between that and being a pirate was that the pirate captain still got more, but there wasn't this enormous gulf between who was on the top and who was on the bottom. Having said that, what kind of money could you make being a pirate in the golden age of piracy?
Well, there was probably an enormous variation depending on how successful your particular gang was and how good your pirate captain was at choosing targets and being in the right place at the right time. And so there's probably no generalized figure we could have. And, of course, there's no income tax return, so it's sometimes piecing together the evidence of various gangs to see what their proceeds were. But for many of these pirate crews, I mean, the sums were absolutely staggering. You know, at a time when you might get 25 pounds for service on a ship for 2-3 years journey, people were ending up with hundreds of pounds in their share of a single day's work or a weekend's work attacking vessels in the entrance to some port. So there were great fortunes to be made.
Let me introduce very quickly again our guest with this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Colin Woodard. He is an award-winning journalist and is author of a recently published book, The Republic of Pirates. It is published by Harcourt, and it's out now in the bookstore if you want to read it, and it's a lot of fun to read. Questions are welcome, too. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. I think certainly some of the names that I mentioned at the beginning and we'll talk about are legendary, guys like Blackbeard, for example. But among pirates, they were also legendary figures as well. And you begin here telling a bit of the story of one of them, a man named Henry Avery. And among pirates, he was legendary because no one, I guess, really knows what happened to him. But the thing that made him famous among pirates was that the belief that he got very rich and he retired and was able to then live comfortably off the spoils for the rest of his life. Now, I guess that's not really clear exactly what did happen to him, but he was famous, at least among pirates, for being the guy who got away with it.
Yeah, I mean, Avery was, in many ways, the role model and avatar of this generation of pirates. He was active when most of these pirates that I'm writing about would have been young men or even teenagers. And his exploits were incredibly famous. He was sort of it was like the O.J. Simpson trial of the day, the exploits of Henry Avery. It was written about everywhere in the newspapers. There were novels written about him. There was a play produced in London about his exploits. And it was said that he had, like many of these pirates who followed him, he'd been an officer on a privateering vessel, which was a private warship, a ship that had been given permission to attack enemy shipping in time of war by the king. And he was an officer on one of these ships, and they were being cheated out of their salaries and had been left stranded in a foreign port and believed that they were going to be turned over to the king of Spain to become slaves. And so he led a mutiny and an uprising against these conditions, took over the ship, and they went to the Indian Ocean and managed to catch a massive treasure galleon belonging to the Grand Mogul of India. And they had so much treasure that just vast, vast quantities. And they ended up dispersing. They sailed around the world to the Bahamas, sold the ship and some of the treasure to the governor of the Bahamas. There was so much money involved that they could actually corrupt the authorities themselves. And then they scattered to the four corners of the world. And some of the crew were captured, but Henry Avery never was. And this legend built that he'd moved to Madagascar with his treasure, which was then hadn't been colonized by by the Europeans yet, and live there, you know, with a, you know, streets paved with gold and massive castles and hundreds of warships and tens of thousands of soldiers, and was supposedly building a grand pirate kingdom and living there with the Grand Mogul of India's daughter and some, you know, wonderful marriage of princess and pirate prince. I mean, the truth of the matter, when you actually look into the records, wasn't so nice. They were, when they captured the treasure ship, there were all sorts of atrocities and brutalities. And it's not clear even what happened to Henry Avery. He may have actually lost all his money and died penniless somewhere in England. But the legend was that he'd been enormously successful, and that clearly inspired many of these pirates who I write about to do what they did.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller here. Well, why don't we bring them into the conversation on our line one in Urbana, here where we are. Hello.
Yes, my question is, what was the life of the pirates like when they weren't pirating? I mean, did they have families, or was it just an all-male society, or what was it?
We don't have a comprehensive picture of what life was like when they were ashore in their pirate base in the Bahamas. That was at New Providence Island, where Nassau, the capital of the Bahamas, was. And they'd moved in there and set up their own sort of pirate republic and fortified a fortress there and were hard to dislodge. We do know that many of the pirate crews preferred to take on new recruits who were not married, because they felt that married men who had families ashore would have divided loyalties and wouldn't be able to pledge, you know, their total undying support to the pirate cause. But that said, we also know that many of the pirates had been married or even were married to people ashore in the Bahamas. There were women there. Many of them were probably involved in commercial relationships rather than church-sanctioned matrimonial ones. But we know that there were a few married couples involved as well. Exactly what happened? Were there any children? Well, there's not references to that in the primary source documents we have. But it's clear that it was a raucous place, and that a lot of pirates spent their rest and recreation time, you know, drinking and carousing and enjoying themselves ashore, all things that they hadn't been allowed to do when they were in the Merchant Marine and the Navy.
Thank you.
All right,
absolutely.
Thank you. Was there some, I mentioned at the beginning that you chose to primarily to focus on four characters closely, Blackbeard and Black Sam and Charles Vane, and then also the man who brought them down, Woods Rogers. Is there some particular reason that you chose them? Was it something about their character, something about that perhaps there you had a goodly amount of material about them and their lives?
Well, I think a lot of previous efforts to tell the story of the pirates have suffered because they followed one individual at a time. And these guys all operated together as a gang. It's best understood to sort of be able to trace the community itself. But also, it makes much better reading to be able to follow a life in biographical form. And so I wanted to do both. So I wanted to take the strands of three key individuals and draw them together, and through their experiences, you'd have a full picture of what this pirate society was like, because between these three individuals, they cross paths with almost all of the characters involved. And then I also wanted to include their nemesis, the person who would confront them, and and tell that person's life as well by contrast. Woods Rogers, the person who would confront the pirates and eventually become governor of the Bahamas after they were pacified. Woods Rogers had been born to a successful merchant family and had been the most famous privateer of a war that had occurred just before this grand piracy outbreak took place, and was somebody with a great heroism and willing to take considerable risks. And I wanted to show sort of both sides of the story.
Yeah.
As to why picking these particular individuals when I was going to select them, in large part because I found them the most interesting. Blackbeard is perhaps the most famous of these pirates to this day, but I also found him the most compelling because he was a strategic thinker and clearly intelligently thought out what his next moves would be, like he was playing chess. Whereas Charles Vane is the other extreme. He was bombastic and impulsive and prone to just, you know, sort of becoming a berserker and attacking vessels, you know, with all guns loaded. So I enjoyed having that broad range of personalities and tactics to give people a sense of the diversity of people who are involved.
Yeah, they were all, these men were all English, right? They were all born in England?
As far as we can tell, yeah. I mean, all of these pirates, their lives and what they were doing before they went into piracy are often murky. But a great number of them were born in England. And there were also a few individuals who've been born in the colonies, including several who weren't impoverished sailors at all. They were members of some of the most wealthy and respectable families in their respective colonies. And these fellows had come from Barbados and Rhode Island and Jamaica and elsewhere. So there was sort of a mix. But in general, most of the pirates were from the English colonies and were English or Irish or Scots in background. But there were a significant number of French pirate crews as well. And scattered throughout the crews were Dutch and Swedes and even Africans. The pirates didn't seem to generally care whether or not you were a runaway slave. You could potentially be an equal member of a lot of the pirate crews. And as word of that got out, large numbers of runaway slaves, because this was a time when the sort of slave societies of Barbados and South Carolina and Jamaica had been perfected, and word had gotten out of this pirate republic, and a lot of people went there, to the so many that an estimated 25% or so of a typical pirate crew were actually of African descent. So it was a mix of nationalities and religions and such, but tended to be dominated by people from the British Isles.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting that the sort of the background to this, in a sense, the setup, and in fact, that maybe some of these people might even have had some of their early experiences. Certainly, I think Woods Rogers did. It's rooted in the politics of the time, particularly a war that had been fought basically between the British and the Dutch and the French and the Spanish, so that most of the pirates, some of these guys who maybe earlier had been privateers, most of the pirates were English, and some of them were Dutch, and obviously, as you say, from other places. But it seems like a lot of the pirates were English, and their targets in the Caribbean, those that they preyed upon, were Spanish, and that was somehow a reflection of this sort of long-standing, maybe it goes all the way back to the Spanish Armada, this long-standing sort of conflict, but particularly between Britain and Spain.
That's generally true. I mean, except that the French, who were also sort of age-old enemies of Britain at that time, seem to have gotten a pass on that. A lot of Frenchmen served in the under British captains within the Bahamas pirate gangs, but also there were several prominent French captains who had majority French crews who were also part of this society and who joined the same fleets with English pirates. So somehow the French and English cooperated despite their differences in the previous wars, but there's almost no instances where Spanish are welcome to join the pirates, or there are Spanish pirate crews who work with them. The Spanish seem to have been regarded in a very different category of enemy than the French had been, and the animosity was enormous, in part perhaps because the Spanish were at that time the haves in the Caribbean. The Spanish controlled most of the Caribbean islands and almost all of the mainland south of what's now the United States, and including much of what's now the United States, and had mountains of, you know, silver and Aztec gold and all sorts of incredibly valuable trade items from the New World that they were trying to ship back to Spain. So they became the preferred target because they had most of the stuff.
We are at our midpoint here, and we have several callers. So, again, we'll go to the phones. And the first in line is over in Belgium community, not too far away from here, line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to include in this topic something that's happening today that is kind of involved with them. And that's the new things they're having about these ships that various people are digging up from the ocean, or dredging up from the ocean, I guess I should say, that contain enormous quantities of gold and silver and jewels and all. And the new laws say that these are supposed to go back to the people who own it. And in most cases, this is the Spanish. Well, I have a question. Doesn't it seem like it should go back to the Incas? Because they really were the ones who were plundered in the first place. And yet the pirates just plundered the Spanish who had plundered the native peoples of the New World.
It's probably some, you know, in justice terms, that's probably true. I haven't followed the latest controversy with this as closely as I probably should have, but in general, maritime law or admiralty law that governs things like the salvage of wrecks has always said that in the case of warships, that those always belong to the government who once owned them. So if you were to find an American aircraft carrier in the bottom of the Pacific, that still remains U.S. government property. But a lot of these ships, like you say, that were treasure galleons, belong to the Spanish. And my understanding is that there's been sort of an argument that even vessels that weren't formally part of the Spanish Navy but served under the Spanish crown have been sort of counted as being warships for this purpose or ships belonging to the sovereign. They've tried to make claim over treasure galleons everywhere. As to whether that's just or how it plays out, I don't know enough about it at this stage to comment on it, but it does, you know, raise a thorny problem and questions and moral questions about, you know, where that treasure had come from and who it rightfully belongs to.
Yes, precisely. And would that still same logic go if we found some pirate ship near? They're always looking for pirate ships that have gone down with their booty also. Well, that obviously can't go back to the pirates, but should it actually go back to the Spanish, or should it go, here again, back to the people who were originally plundered?
Well, in general, the sort of laws on salvage, you know, other than the exception for warships, has been if you find something abandoned and you salvage it, it belongs to the person who salvages it, because they take on the risk and the expense of recovering it. And also the original idea was if you were salvaging these otherwise lost goods, it was good in general for the world's economy, and that there ought to be an incentive for people to do that, you know, back in the day. So I assume that in general, most pirate vessels that would be discovered would belong to the salvors themselves. And once if you start trying to historically figure out who it really should belong to, you could be at work for a long time, not only assigning, you know, who originally would have dug these things out of the ground and who it belonged to, but just trying to figure out who is the inheritor 400 or 500 years later of that becomes a very sticky problem. Hmm. So it might be a ball of wax that may be far too troublesome to open up, because I don't think that there are any clear-cut answers this many centuries have gone by to those kind of questions.
Well, we have some other folks to talk with. Let's go next to someone in Charleston, Illinois, that is. Line one. Hello.
Yes, join the program. three things I'd like to compliment the caller from Belgium, because he's pointing up the adverse effects of colonialism, and that's rarely the subject matter anymore. But the second thing is, I don't think anything has changed. Piracy as a paradigm is still acted out every day of our lives, and we are subject to those sorts of lawlessness. And my case in point is, and I heard this man referred to as a pirate by some learned folks in the person of Rupert Murdoch. Now, this fellow in his pirate vessel is sailing up to the Dow Jones, you know, and going to get ownership of the Wall Street Journal as a form of booty, increasing his empire and his strength and his armada of methods. The last thing I would like to say is that this very morning, I went to our local courthouse and paid a traffic violation with a minor accident involved. The fine was going to be $75, and I never rejected that. I was at fault. But I was informed that if I wanted to bypass a moving violation, that for triple the amount of the fine, I could do that, and it would be expunged from my record. Now, now that is sort of a some degree of piracy. If I'm looking up, I was a hostage. You know, I had to make a minute decision about what to do. Well, being an old man, I said, well, I'll just pay a little fine, and I'll just go about my business. But there I had the, in the venue of being held hostage and separated from my money. So it's a very good program, David, and I mean, it is so germane to today's life. We have these TV shows that instant millionaires, the lottery, and get-rich-quick schemes and stuff that just have saturated the social conditions and the penchant to equate riches with independence and power. So I'll ring off and listen. And thank you very much.
Well, I don't know what kind of comment you want to make on that. Certainly there are pirates and then there are pirates.
I mean, as a as a journalist and a citizen, I'm enormously concerned about the consolidation of our media, and I think it's had a corrosive effect on public discourse and our democracy itself. But it's sort of a separate issue from the pirates. I would say, though, Rupert Murdoch is voracious in his acquisitions, and his media empire has some questionable balance. I would say that in drawing parallels or analogies to the particular pirate era that I'm dwelling in, I would say Rupert Murdoch more resembles the people the pirates were taking on than the pirates themselves. I mean, the pirates were involved in a sort of radical, roughshod, democratic uprising to sort of level conditions on the ships and to take on the sort of wealthy and powerful figures within the empire who were squeezing ordinary people. And ordinary people were responding. I mean, during the height of this piracy outbreak, there are all these letters from, you know, the authorities, people like Governor Spotswood in Virginia and the Attorney General of South Carolina and Cotton Mather in Massachusetts, and they're all fuming about these horrible pirates, and they're villains of all nations and demons, and they must be rounded up at all costs. But in the same breaths, in the same letters, they're all complaining about how great numbers of people in their respective colonies look upon the pirates as heroes, not villains, and are rooting for them. So, I would draw the analogies differently, and also add that trying to draw any historical analogies over time is always a tricky thing.
All right. Well, let's go on to Champaign County. This is line two. Hello.
Right. I also applaud the insight from Belgium, Illinois, that the Law of the Sea was written by the victors, of course, and an immiserated population in Bolivia might feel a little different about the gold that was ripped from them, even though it was centuries ago. As far as contemporary analogies, I think a good one is the mercenaries that are employed in our various theaters of war right now. I'm talking more about the idea that pirates, not just freebooting pirates, but the privateers, the people that were authorized to pillage an opposing empire's ships, as opposed to just people who were out for some kind of escape from them being impressed into service by the crown or whatever. I think the idea that the crown wouldn't be responsible for the privateer and what they did on the side is comparable to the mercenary activity in Iraq or Afghanistan, it seems to me, or maybe in the Horn of Africa. I don't know where they're all employed, but I think that's the contemporary analogy. I'm wondering whether you're familiar with the parable of Aquinas, the pirate and the emperor?
I don't believe so, no.
It's not very well represented on the web. I was actually kind of surprised. I only found a couple of references. It apparently, there's one attribution says that it wasn't really his story, but the idea is the pirate is brought before the emperor and, you know, wants to be, has his say before he's killed, and he says, basically, you molest entire nations with your fleets. I have one boat, and that's all I do. I'm doing the same thing as you. And Aquinas apparently offers that as a way of underlining the illegality of the emperor as well as the pirate, which is belaboring. There's also a long treatise by Buckminster Fuller about how piracy and exploration led to the, you know, the law of sea, as I referred to earlier, and the law of nations, and the economic structure that we have today, which is an interesting digression. Not, again, not terribly well represented on a simple web search, but I'm just wondering what kind of the phase that you're looking at is when the gold was flowing out full speed out of the New World, and it was probably a different instance. But even the as you mentioned, Mather was writing about pirates, and I don't suppose he was writing about the pirates in the Mediterranean, where the U.S. Was having problems with the Barbary pirates.
Yeah, that was much later. You know, this is 1715, 1720, and that was early 19th century, long after U.S. independence. So
right,
that wasn't
right.
That wasn't what they were.
I understand
they were
that, but I'm just saying that. But they couldn't be writing about that, obviously. But I'm just the grand scheme of things is that pirates and privateers, particularly, were used to sort of buy governments to and well to control trade, basically. You know,
the privateers certainly. I mean, that was the idea of, and all the governments had incentive to do it and did, because the seas were very large and the ability of navies to patrol them all was extremely limited. So there was an incentive to hire mercenaries or soldiers of fortune to essentially go out there and prey on the enemy's shipping, and perhaps just the presence of these private warships would also make your own shipping more secure. As to the pirates, the pirates by definition didn't have anyone's permission, and most of them were preying on everybody's shipping. There were a few pirates who had scruples about attacking English ships, but in general, these guys were attacking everybody's vessels and raiding colonies of all the nations. So they were the loose cannons who were didn't seem to be under anybody's control.
We have just about 10 minutes left in this part of the show, and our guest is Colin Woodard. He's a journalist. He's the author of a number of books, including one we talked about here on this program, The Lobster Coast, the subtitle that, Rebels, Rusticators, and the Struggle for a Forgotten Frontier. Also, Ocean's End, Travels Through Endangered Seas. He's a foreign correspondent for Christian Science Monitor and the Chronicle of Higher Education. He lives in Maine, Portland, Maine. His most recent book is The Republic of Pirates, the subtitle being The True and Surprising Story of the Caribbean Pirates and the Man Who Brought Them Down. It's published by Harcourt. One of the things I want to make sure that we talk a little bit about is, you know, we talked earlier about the fact that the pirates, that we have this period, a roughly 10-year period, where the pirates became very powerful, at least in terms of the kind of force they could bring to bear to their occupation. 20 or 30 captains, maybe some thousands of men, a number of ships. And as you said, what happened was as the pirates would capture a ship, they would continue to trade up so that they had formidable force at to the point where the Royal Navy decided they didn't even want to have anything to – they didn't want to try. They didn't want to take them on. What – and in how – you know, when we talk about pirate republic, how formal was that? Are we just talking about the fact that they had a very significant power base there in the Caribbean, or were – did they indeed penetrate to some degree? Did they penetrate local government?
The pirate republic itself – seem to have been relatively informal. I mean, each of the pirate ships, they had this sort of reordering of the way the government of the ship worked, and they had sort of a town meeting form of government where they would have a council and everyone would vote by popular vote on all the major decisions as to what should be done and who should lead them. Ashore, it seems, again, we don't have a comprehensive account of how it worked, but it seems from the circumstantial evidence that the various pirate commodores each sort of controlled a faction of pirates, and collectively they sort of ran the island without a supreme leader, but with a number of political factions who were all, you know, reporting based on which captain was in control. And eventually this was used against the pirates when Woodes Rogers is finally sent to confront them. He uses a carrot-and-stick strategy that he's able to sell the King of England on, where there's a royal pardon offered to anyone who will surrender. Mm-hmm. Basically, if you took the pardon, all of your past piracies would be absolved. And so there was enormous incentive for these guys to take it and keep their treasure and be able to go back to respectability. And about roughly half of the pirates broke into this political faction who wanted to collude with Woodes Rogers. The other half were the diehards who didn't want to give up what they'd been doing, and included many of the most aggrieved of the merchant sailors, but also a number of these more pirates from more wealthy and influential backgrounds who appear to have been involved in the had political motivations. They appear to have been involved in trying to restore the deposed House of Stuart to the British throne, and so were not willing to give up their political rebellion as well.
So how was it that Rogers was able then to take on even those that remained that decided they weren't going to take the pardon and that they were going to continue to be pirates?
Well, not to spoil the whole story for everyone, but there was this divide and conquer strategy, and it did succeed in dividing the pirates. Had he not done that, even though he was backed by several Royal Navy vessels and had a whole company of soldiers, mercenary soldiers he'd hired and brought with him, he probably would have had no hope of taking control of the island. But the pirates themselves were divided, and a number of them scattered off from the Bahamas and continued their piracies, but with the plan of returning and deposing Rogers and his government. And Rogers was on a knife's edge for a number of years because the population of pirates who agreed to collude with him, a lot of the pirates started getting second thoughts as time passed, and more were defecting and working against him. So it was a very difficult tightrope that Rogers was walking, made even more difficult by the fact that the war with Spain resumed not long after he came to the Bahamas, and the island was threatened with outright invasion by the Spanish as well.
He was quite the character. He had been a privateer. He was a very experienced blue water sailor, certainly. What made him want to do this, to take on this very difficult job that even the British Royal Navy really would rather not have clearly would rather not have dealt with?
Well, I think part of it is his background being the inheritor of a large Bristol-based merchant family. You know, he owned ships himself. He took great losses, and his family took great losses from enemy privateers during the war that had preceded the outbreak of piracy. And he himself had led the most famous privateering expedition of that war. He sailed around the world at a time when only a handful of men had done so, to attack Spanish shipping in the Pacific Ocean. They came back with a treasure galleon, and during his voyages, he became aware of the various pirates who were hiding out in Madagascar in the Indian Ocean, including some of Henry Avery's old crewmen. And they weren't living there with streets paved with gold and massive cities and hundreds of warships. They were more living like castaways, in the woods, but doing small scale raiding on ships and shipping. And he later visited that island and wanting to confront the pirates. And he got this idea while there and interacting with the pirates that if they were offered clemency, that many of them might surrender and be rehabilitated and made proper citizens of the empire. There also seems to have been some religious motivation on Roger's part. He was constantly buying large parcels of religious missionary tracts to give to pirates to try to convert them spiritually as well. So it seemed to have been a mission motivated by both his personal economic interests, his sense of what is of service to the empire, and his perhaps religious motivations as well. Mm-hmm. I would say as a caveat in understanding the moral complexity of all these issues, Woodes Rogers would not be seen as a heroic figure these days. His family, one of the main products of their merchant activities, was slave trading, and he continued doing that throughout the period, which I find a striking contrast between him and the pirates themselves.
I think it was interesting too. I think Rogers is associated with another rather famous sailor, a man named William Dampier, who was a buccaneer himself, who was, I guess, Dampier was a friend of Rogers' father, who was also named Woodes Rogers. Is that
right? Yeah, as far as we can put together, exactly. Yeah.
And that he was certainly a sailor of note of his time, would have been older than than Woods Rogers the younger, but that the two of them sail together.
Yeah, and the circumnavigation of the world, which took Rogers 3 years, Dampier was hired as his chief pilot because Dampier had circumnavigated the world as a buccaneer and knew many of the sea routes and knew where Spanish targets might be found and such. So he was hired for that all important mission of taking the vessels across the Pacific. And Rogers probably did learn quite a bit about the how pirates would operate and about their various tactics and stuff from Dampier. Dampier actually had known and served with Henry Avery, the pirate who was sort of the role model for this generation. He'd been, oddly enough, by strange coincidence, an officer in another vessel in the same privateering fleet that that Henry Avery was in and had witnessed Avery's mutiny. And oddly enough, he seemed to feel somewhat sympathetic towards the mutineers, even though he didn't join them. Realizing how cheated and how aggrieved they were, he actually took the time to testify in some of the court cases that followed against some of Avery's crewmen. So that was definitely an enormous source of information that Rogers could have tapped on for understanding and perhaps the psychology of the pirates and how best to confront them.
Yeah. It's interesting, again, that for we talked a little bit earlier about the fact that there was there are many legendary pirates. Well, among pirates, there are also legendary pilots and pirates, and the Avery certainly was one because he was the one who was said to have gotten away with it and inspired a lot of younger men, this generation of guys like Bellamy and Vane and Blackbeard to go into the business. But none of them really, their experiences were, well, we don't know about Avery, but the experiences of these men were rather different. In fact, nobody got away with it.
None of this particular group of individuals did, no. Although some of their colleagues did. I mean, not all of these pirates. I mean, some of them, a lot of the pirates surrendered and got away with it, so to speak, and that they kept their treasure and then returned to respectability. But a number of the pirates who refused to surrender did get away. They were never captured and faded away into obscurity with their treasure. And a number of them may have made their way, oddly enough, back to Madagascar and joined, you know, the remnants of Henry Avery's crew living out there in the, you know, Margaritaville of the early early 1700s.
It's you said that part of the reason for choosing these characters was because you wanted to tell the story of several different individuals, people who were really different, and that perhaps all of them were compelling. Tell us a little bit, and unfortunately now we're just about at the end. What about them particularly, or was there one character among them in particularly that emerges as someone that you just found really fascinating?
Well, I found Blackbeard the most interesting, as I said before, because of his strategic thinking. And he's clever enough that he sees the writing on the wall towards the end and decides to switch tactics. He does take the king's pardon, but he takes it from the governor of North Carolina, which was then an impoverished colony. And he basically bought off the governor of North Carolina and set himself up as a Tony Soprano-like figure. He bought the governor's protection, and the governor looked the other way while he continued operating an underground piracy operation and selling a lot of the goods, apparently, to the governor himself, because a lot of his plunder wound up under a haystack in the barn of the governor's neighbor, the collector of customs of North Carolina, where it was discovered later when the governor of Virginia decided he'd had enough and launched an illegal invasion of his southern neighbor in order to capture Blackbeard. So Blackbeard's you know, careful planning ahead, I find, I've always found quite interesting in putting together how he motivated his crews and used a visage of terror, you know, lighting. He put lighted fuses in his beard, which would burn, and when he went into battle, it would be flames and smoke pouring off his head to terrify his opponents into surrendering without a shot. And indeed, you know, most of them did, you know, through all the documentary evidence, most of which is coming from Blackbeard's victims. There's not a single instance where Blackbeard kills anybody prior to his final life and death battle with the Royal Navy.
Well, that's, I guess, one wonders. Yeah, certainly I'm sure these people did commit heinous crimes, but it also would seem to be in their interest to promote the idea that they were vicious, unprincipled, and would kill you as soon as look at you, because then that would make it more likely that if they sailed up to your ship, you would not try to fight them off. You'd just say, fine, here, go ahead, take it.
That was absolutely their tactic. And what I found most interesting is, you know, unlike the buccaneering generation that preceded them and a lot of pirates who've come since, most of these pirates were incredibly discreet in their use of force. They tried to scare people, but in most accounts, and again, almost everything we know about them comes from the testimony of their victims, by most accounts, they rarely hurt anybody and usually were treating people civilly. They'd scare them and they'd take their stuff, but usually were not mistreating anybody. They would put their captives back in a vessel, you know, later and send them on their way and let them go free. And that's in stark contrast to the behavior of people like Sir Henry Morgan in the previous generation, who's taking cities and, you know, torturing and killing everybody, and many of the pirates who've come since, all the way through to the pirates of today. Mm. And their behavior in that time is in stark contrast to conditions within legal societies around them. I mean, the conditions in London and the increasing masses of the poor and on the slave plantation societies of Jamaica and South Carolina and Barbados, like Jamaica, slaves outnumbered the Europeans 8-1 at this point. The repressive measures and the sort of horror of life in legally sanctioned society dwarf what the pirates were doing. I mean, you read things that they did that seem astonishing and brutal to our ears, but when you start reading more about society around them, the pirates start looking relatively good.
Well, it's a great story. The book is The Republic of Pirates. It's published by Harcourt, by our guest, Colin Woodard. Thanks very much for giving us some of your time.
A great pleasure being here. Thank you for having me.